Well, let's jump ahead. What about further education then that came in California? As you were a 10-year-old, you were in the fifth grade, but when you came to California, then you continued your education.
It was radically different. In California, there are hundreds of students in the schools, and not like a little tiny school like ours. And so we all went to the public schools and went to junior high school and went to high school. Some of us went to college and all hated school, quite frankly. My poor brother, one of my brothers, we got new clothes and went to California, but my brother had a pair of overalls that he liked to wear, which didn't work in San Francisco. And we had an unusual last name and spoke with an Oklahoma accent. It was quite an adjustment. And looking back on that now, I think it was an incredible adjustment.
What years are we talking about? The year you moved to California? What year?
It was 1956.
Okay. So then you did go on to college?
I did go on to college.
And where was that?
I went to college at a junior college in San Bruno, California, Skyline College, and I went to San Francisco State. And then when I came back here, I went to the University of Arkansas. I went to graduate school for a little while, and then when I was in graduate school, I was in a car wreck.
And I want to come to that.
Okay. After I had the car wreck, it was so extensive that I did not go back to graduate school. But I have 18 honorary doctorates, so I guess it's okay.
You were married at a very young age in California.
I was married at 18. Mm-hmm.
And then you had children from that marriage.
I have two daughters, one of whom was supposed to be here today, but she's out today, Felicia, who's Chad's assistant. And the other is Gina.
And when you refer to Chad, that's the principal chief of the Cherokees,
right.
Chad
mm-hmm.
Smith.
Right.
So it was during the 60s that your political conscience perhaps
right.
was born.
Right.
Your concern for Native American issues became major to you. I think when students occupied the abandoned prison at Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, that was a big time for you in your life.
It was a big time. At that time, when the occupation occurred, it was in November of 1969, and I had been married for about 5 years. My daughters are very young. We were living a pretty middle-class life. I was involved somewhat in the San Francisco Indian Center. But the world was changing around us. In the San Francisco Bay Area, during the late 60s, you could go hear Janis Joplin in a park, or hear Jimi Hendrix in a park, or go to the Fillmore and hear some of the most famous bands in Jefferson Airplane. The music was changing. The politics were changing. San Francisco was the home to a huge anti-war movement. UC Berkeley across the bay was where a lot of the free speech movement occurred. And then there were a lot of women's rights issues being discussed. Civil rights issues were very prominent. So the occupation of Alcatraz Island happened within that context of the music changing, civil rights, women's rights, middle-class white kids coming to San Francisco trying to find a way to live that was different than how their parents lived. It was a time of just change everywhere. During that time, some students from UC Berkeley and San Francisco State occupied Alcatraz Island, citing the provision of an old treaty that provided that excess federal land would revert to Native American people. I was 24, 25 in 1969, and so these were people who were a little bit younger than me or about my age who were literally standing up to the United States government and talking about Native rights and about the conditions in tribal communities across the country. And I didn't know people like that. There was something very liberating about seeing people talk about those issues. My dad had been active in the San Francisco Bay Area Indian community. I remember seeing him on television one time talking about the need for a clinic. And so we were used to issues and people being involved and my parents bringing home people who were down on their luck to stay with us for a little while or finding money to give them when they didn't have money to give to us kids, but they found some to give to a stranger. So we were used to issues, but not that way. It had a profound impact on me. And it's kind of like when I took my little girls and went on the boat from San Francisco over to Alcatraz, my life changed and I never went back, never looked back from that time. I became much more involved in Native issues, and, you know, eventually all that work led me home.
The occupation of Alcatraz Island, they felt that island needed to be returned to the tribes.
Right, mm-hmm.
Because that was rightfully theirs, right, and mm-hmm, the government right. had taken it away.
Right. They had proposals. One proposal was to turn it into a museum, a Native American museum. tribute to the California Indians. There were lots of, you know, ideas thrown around for the long-term use of the island.
How did that come to an end? How was that resolved?
Eventually, people drifted away. A lot of the people who occupied Alcatraz Island, one of them lives here in Oklahoma in Okmulgee. Linda Arenado was one of the original students who went over on the boat. She's a doctor, a physician, and she was a student at UC Berkeley. So as time went on, the students went back to school and new people came. And as with any organization, some of the new people didn't have the same vision as the older people. And so the population dwindled. And then eventually the last few remaining people were removed by the federal marshals in 1972.
Federal government didn't try to remove anybody in the height of this?
No.